Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I know Obama was 7 cents, but ever since Trump won, it proved that I could be president.
Yeah, you can, it wasn't cold though. Don't they go against the teachers that yay talk for?
Yo, Tip, I hear your side and everybody talk though, but ain't going against the grain everything I fought for.
Probably so, yay.
And with Kanye West bringing us in, Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we conclude our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. Starting with 1948, we've spent much of the last 6 weeks playing historical audio and speaking with guests and taking your oral history calls to help reconstruct how we got to this place of such intense polarization and alienation as we are in today. Yesterday, we released findings from a WNYC Harris poll that sought to learn from a wide cross-section of Americans about some things that unite us and some things that divide us, and look for opportunities to move forward more as one country while respecting people's differences and how alienated different groups of Americans can feel. Yesterday, we also got reactions to the series and the poll results from Fordham political science professor Christina Greer. And today we'll hear a proposal later this hour from Tamara Drought from the think tank Demos for how whites and people of color in the American working class can find political power in common goals rather than be doomed to permanent culture war combatant status. That's coming up. First, with us one last time, is Michael D'Antonio, executive editor of the Harris Poll and author of books including The Athena Doctrine, How Women and the Men Who Think Like Them Will Rule the Future, The Truth About Trump, and a forthcoming book later this summer about Mike Pence called The Shadow President. And we'll also get some thoughts from someone who's been on the conservative side of many of these issues as a 20-year conservative talk show host in Milwaukee, Charlie Sykes, who many of you know because he's also done some hosting in our series Indivisible, and who has also written books like in 2012, A Nation of Moochers, America's Addiction to Getting Something for Nothing, and back in the 90s, A Nation of Victims, The Decay of the American Character, and a book on education called Dumbing Down Our Kids, but who is also a big critic of Donald Trump and his movement, and released a book last year that many of you have heard him talk about called How the Right Lost Its Mind. Hi, Michael. Hi, Charlie. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Michael, relevant to today's news is that the poll found immigration is a very divisive issue, as if we didn't know. But here are some numbers. 60% of white Americans told us that reducing the number of immigrants and refugees would have a positive effect on our country, while 57% of Latinos said it would have a negative effect to reduce the number of immigrants and refugees. African Americans were divided at close to 50-50. How much would it be accurate to say that the poll found immigration to be among the most polarizing issues demographically?
Well, I think it is. Obviously, the numbers do show that. And what's remarkable is when we go back at Harris to look at this historically, we see many of the same things arising in the 70s and in the 80s. Americans were really ambivalent and actually negative on allowing refugees from Vietnam to come to America in the 70s. And the majority thought that Jimmy Carter had handled the Cuban immigration crisis poorly as well. 30 years later, many people welcome the Cuban community in their midst, and Vietnamese refugees have become productive citizens, many of them elected officials in parts of the country. So
let me linger on that for just a second, because it was one of the most interesting things to me from the historic Harris polls that we were looking over together in the context of this series, that the South Vietnamese refugees fleeing communism after we lost the war, and similarly public opinion being against the many Cuban refugees from Castro's communist dictatorship when there was that big boat lift in 1980 that was tens of thousands of Cubans in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. But still, what's consistent from then to now, I guess, on even those politically sympathetic populations, maybe much more inherently sympathetic in a political sense than the refugees from the Middle East now or from Central America. But even in those cases, large numbers of refugees tested negative.
They did. And it was a heavy lift for presidents in those times, Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, to persuade the American people that we should take this responsibility. It was an argument made on a moral basis, but it also drew on historical experience, which showed that waves of immigrants have been welcomed to our shores and well integrated into our society and culture. And it's a net gain, but it's a long-term project.
Charlie, any impression of that through line? This may be the first time you're hearing about those historic polls, but what are you thinking so far as you hear Michael?
Well, I do remember that. I am old enough to remember that. And this is where thought leadership becomes so important, that that you actually have faith leaders, political leaders make the case for integration. We didn't have a president of the United States who decided to demonize, talk about immigrants infesting the country. You know, historically, going back, well over a century, obviously, the integration of new waves of immigrants has always been somewhat controversial, which is, again, why every generation needs to go back and say, okay, we are a nation of immigrants. The immigrants enrich the country. We are the shining city on the hill. And so, I do remember those debates. And there was a division, at least on both the right and the left, about immigration. And it's interesting to sort of, feel how both sides have evolved on that.
And Charlie, you mentioned Reagan. One thing that struck me in researching this series was how big a culture war figure Ronald Reagan was. I know that's hardly news, but he was for what we consider socially conservative positions on abortion and affirmative action and education and the environment. And his rise from marginal Goldwater supporter status in 64 to governor of California and then president in 1980 was largely built on the enthusiasm of those constituencies, not unlike Trump, I think it's fair to say, but as you point out, he was different from today's populists on at least this one big issue, immigration. And so we're going to play one last Ronald Reagan clip. This is from a campaign debate in 1980, seeming to aspire to open borders, even using that term.
Rather than making them or talking about putting up a fence, why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back and they can cross and open the border both ways.
Open the border both ways. And he started out by talking about the wall proposal at that time. Ronald, meet Donald. Donald, Ronald. And Charlie, was Reagan out of touch with the base even then? Or what do you think happened that Reagan so dramatically lost the culture war within the Republican Party on this?
Well, he didn't lose it necessarily during his presidency. In fact, remember, later in the 1980s, he signed a sweeping amnesty bill, which really did not break apart the party. I do think, again, this was very much Ronald Reagan's point of view. You know, his last speech at the Shining City on a Hill, he talked about, if there must be walls, there need to be doors, very open doors. And he had a very, very different view. And I think this is, two different strains on the right. You do always have the nativist right, the people who believe, the kind of the blood and soil view of what America is, versus this more aspirational point of view. And, quite frankly, I was under the mistaken impression that Reagan's view had become the dominant view in the Republican Party. And perhaps it did among the political elites, but certainly not among the base. And of course, there were people who were willing to go out and were willing to stoke the distrust of immigration. And that obviously paid tremendous dividends. And it took a lot of people by surprise to realize how broad and deep that nativist base still was, even after Ronald Reagan.
So listeners, we've done our oral history call-ins during this series. It was so great to hear from some of you early on who are old enough to have remembered 1948 and 1958 in some of the aspects that we talked about when we did those shows, and of course up through 2008 last week. And now on this last day, We'll invite you, instead of to look back or to just talk about the present, because we do that every day, we'll invite you to predict the future. How about that? So the question is, how polarized and how much in a state of culture war will the United States be 10 years from now, 2028? What's the best case scenario, listeners? What's the worst case scenario? And what's needed to bring the country together without compromising unacceptably on anyone's rights or interests? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I know this is a big question. This is a tough question. But again, we'll invite you to predict the future and help sort of describe what the most positive path to the most positive future might be. How polarized and how much in a state of culture war will the United States be 10 years from now, 2028? What's the best case scenario? What's the worst case scenario as we conclude our series, The Eights? And what's needed to bring the country together without compromising unacceptably on anyone's rights or interests? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Michael and Charlie, can I ask you that same question? Where might we be in 10 years? Best and worst case scenario, Michael?
Well, you know, the worst case scenario, I think, has been communicated to me by a lot of people who contact me through social media and will say, we who oppose what Trump is promoting in terms of these divisive messages about immigrants or the culture war, we have to become even more strident on our side. You know, so that I've had actually a whole community of psychoanalysts contact me and say, there's something pathological going on here and people have to be just as outspoken and just as aggressive. Now, that's possible, and it could be that we're going to descend further with people staking out extreme positions. But the other thing that I noticed from our data is that when we ask people about alienation, the closer you get to home, the less alienated people feel. So when we asked about the people running the country, they don't really care about what happens to me, 78% agreed. But when we ask people, do you feel left out of things going on around you, which is local, only 46% agreed. And I think what's happened over the years is that those who mobilize locally, and whether it was Barack Obama in 2008 or Donald Trump mobilizing locally on social media in 2016, they get the advantage. And it's possible that there will be an element of unity that's promoted by some organizers and leaders, as Charlie calls them, thought leaders, and we could be brought to a better place where our more positive impulses and values are expressed.
Charlie, same question.
I think things, I agree with Michael, I think things are likely to get worse before they get better. I think that one of the things that we're seeing is the increased tribalization of American politics. I mean, just think about the reaction to what's going on the border right now. And I think that this is where I think that the focus just on Donald Trump sometimes misses the point. It's what Donald Trump is doing to the political culture, the harshness masquerading as toughness, the callousness mimicking strength, that he really has brought in, you know, some of the darker and uglier strains. And I do think that it is pushing both sides to be, you know, to go back into their corners. I do think the alternative reality silos of the media are becoming more intense. So in that sense, I think that the coarsening of the culture, the divisions of the culture are going to intensify over the next maybe at least half decade. Longer term, I agree with Michael about the trends, the long-term trends, but also the demographic trends. You look at the millennials, their attitudes are very, very different than the older generation. I hesitate to actually say this out loud, but to a certain extent, some of the worst elements of our culture will be dying out over time as America changes.
Well, that's,
and begins
that's
to
my
redefine
generation,
itself.
Charlie.
Mine too. That's why I said I was reluctant to basically say it.
But you're right.
you know, the toxification of the culture, it's not going to be fixed quickly or easily. And I think that, as you're going to see, that that the president and many of his supporters are going to really rely on this kind of divisive politics, you know, to get reelected through the midterms. And that's going to have a long-term impact on American, you know, the American political culture 20 or 30 years from now. I think it's possible we will still be paying the price for all of this. On the other hand, maybe at some point you step back and you go, wow, we need to really rethink who we are as a country, how we relate to one another. And I think that debate, that discussion is already beginning, including what we're doing right now.
We'll continue in a minute with Michael D'Antonio and Charlie Sykes, and we'll get to Tamara Drought a little later, and we'll take your calls right after the break on this final edition of The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade, here on The Brian Lehrer Show.
You just reading the headlines. You don't see the fine print. You on some choosing side. I'm on some unified.
It's bigger than your selfish agenda. If your election ain't gonna stop police from murdering.
Bruh, I never ever stop fighting for the people. Actually wearing the hat to show people that we equal.
You gotta see the vantage point of the people. What makes you feel equal?
Yay versus the people. Yay Kanye West on this final edition of The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. A few more minutes with Michael D'Antonio, executive editor of the Harris Poll, as we've done this WNYC Harris Poll survey, looking at what divides us, what might bring us together. And Charlie Sykes, 20-year conservative talk show host in Milwaukee, recently the author of the book How the Right Lost Its Mind. And the question on the table for all of you, and our lines are full with people who want to answer it: where will we be in the culture wars in 2028, 10 years from now, and what could bring about the best case scenario? Chuck in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Brian. It's a pleasure to listen to you every single day here on WNYC. I would like to say that we are going to be closer and we are going to be better as a country 10 years from now, and the culture wars will be just a little bit less intense. And the reason is because we will know each other more as more and more people come to America, as the populations begin to blend in different areas, people get to know one another, and that takes away the fear. If you look at the Supreme Court decision with respect to gay marriage, most Americans, believe it or not, agree with that. Why? Everybody has a gay person in their family. That humanizes gay people. It allows us to remove the stigma that is attached to the bigotry of homophobia, and it allows us, in humanizing those people, to accept the fact that they should not be denied human rights. The same thing will happen with race. The same thing will happen with immigration, because as we blend as a nation, we will get to know one another. I don't think I'm being Pollyanna. All you have to do is walk through Queens. If you're a racist in Queens, you would have to kill yourself. So there you have it.
Chuck, thank you very much. I think a more pessimistic take on some of the same dynamics might come from Leon in Manhattan. Leon, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I think it's going to get much worse. I'd like to believe what the previous caller just said, but I think the year that's actually driving the culture wars that we're having now is the year 2048, because it's around that time that demographic experts, anyway, think that white people will finally become a minority. And Republicans have seen those reports just like everyone else. They're extremely afraid of white people become a minority, and so they're preparing now. They're trying to create an old-style South Africa here where, well, of course, in South Africa, it was a white minority ruling over a black majority. Here, they want to create a country where a white minority, a minority within the white population, will rule over a multicolored majority. And it's the year 2048 that they're so afraid of that's driving them now. And I agree that the younger generation is and much more accepting of diversity and different people. And I think that's a positive sign. But I think people are underestimating just how greedy Republicans are for gaining power and maintaining power. Look at how they all caved into Trump.
Leon, I'm going to leave it there for time. I thank you very much for that contrasting point of view from our previous caller. And, you know, I was looking at census figures. Michael, census projections. I was looking for that 2048 stat that Leon just referred to, and another one that I came up with was by 2060, there will likely be, according to census projections, about 36% whites in this country, 32% Latinos, and then Asians and African Americans. So that is a very different country, at least ethnically, than this country has been in the past.
Well, it is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be that different politically. When you look at Latino political views, many of them fall into a more conservative pattern. Many of them could identify with a Republican Party that opens toward them. That's what Reince Priebus wanted after when he was running the Republican Party. But I think a lot of this has more to do with the personal leadership style of a demagogic person like Donald Trump. I'm not sure that Americans are willing to fight a culture war on an extreme level for decades. And we noticed in the polling some very interesting indicators where the young were concerned. They're less attached to things like private property, less attached to things like political party identification. They see an opportunity to seek power and meaning in their lives outside of those realms, as citizens, maybe as members of a community, even neighborhood activism. I don't think that lacking the demagogue, we're as vulnerable to this hyper-conflict as people fear.
Charlie, you want to weigh in on these kind of utopian versus dystopian visions of our multicultural future that the callers, you know, maybe it's not for nothing that Queens has an avenue, a street that, in fact, I had Father's Day dinner on this week called Utopia Parkway. So is it Queens Utopia or is it Leon's Dystopia?
Yeah, well, I'm from Wisconsin, so we have a slightly different perspective on all of that. There's no question about it. I mean, already we have become a multicultural society that is dramatically different than, say, you know, where we were when we passed the immigration reforms of 1965. You know, part of the problem, though, is this hyper-segregation of the country. I have to tell you that there are, you know, wide swaths of the state of Wisconsin where you could walk through or drive through and you will not see somebody who is non-white. So we are not necessarily there. But I do think, and it was interesting that Michael raised Reince Priebus's name, because it wasn't that long ago that Priebus was the chairman of the Republican Committee and came out with that autopsy after the 2012 defeat and said, look, you know, we have no future as a ruling party, as a national party. If we lose young people, if we lose minorities, if we lose, you know, Hispanics, we are dead. And of course, what the Republican Party proceeded to do was the exact opposite of everything suggested in that report. And of course, Reince Priebus himself, you know, as an indicator, flips and becomes Donald Trump's chief of staff. I don't know how the Republicans will recover among Hispanic voters. I think they are going to own this for a generation. And I think that nationally, the Republican Party might face the same sort of a fate that it faced in California. You might remember, you know, in California, they took a very strong anti-illegal immigrant stand. They won for a while, and now it is a one-party state. In a lot of ways, you know, demographics are political future. Michael's absolutely right. Hispanics are, you know, quite culturally conservative on a lot of different things. But I think this image of Donald Trump and what's happening right now is going to leave an indelible mark on the party.
From our poll, Michael, what would have a negative impact on our country? That was one of the questions with a list of items. And one of the things that ranked divisive was more social justice movements. 47% said more social justice movements would have a negative impact. So that means around that many said that it would have a positive impact. So social justice is divisive in that question. And it's interesting to me that it tests that way, more than being against discrimination, which tested as a much more positive value. So maybe it's just the language, the word social justice test more hot than fighting discrimination. But here's a clip of conservative talk show host Glenn Beck from just a few years ago. We used this previously in the series, but we bring it forward again for today because it's relevant to our poll findings, when one of the main things on his show was urging his audience to reject any idea framed as being for social justice.
Everything we see being pushed down the throats of the American people right now, TARP, the stimulus package, healthcare, now immigration reform, the bailouts, cap and trade, they really have one thing in common, the PR campaign. If not all, most of them contain these two words, social justice.
And I gather he has since moved away from thinking that social justice should be seen as a dirty word. But obviously that had some resonance among a very large audience that he had at that time. It sounds like that clip was about 2009 or so.
Yeah, he has moved away from that. What's interesting to think about, I think, is that the idea of social justice actually goes back a long way and was a religious concept. Liberal Catholics and many black activists that came out of the black church use that term every day as they promoted their causes. It makes people uncomfortable, and I think that these ideas are intended to make people uncomfortable. Whites often resent the notion that, well, I'm somehow responsible for the sins of the past because of my race, and it's easy to stir up anger at this concept. So it's never, I think, going to poll above 50%. It's not that kind of term. It's really a thing that people associate with moralizing. They resent it after a while. And it goes in cycles. There will be times when those concepts find reception across America, and there will be many times when people say, well, I just don't have the bandwidth or the room in my soul to consider some of these issues as deeply as you're asking me to.
Charlie, did you leave the culture wars, or did the culture wars leave you? You wrote A Nation of Moochers, America's Addiction to Getting Something for Nothing in 2012, and in the 90s, A Nation of Victims, The Decay of the American Character, and your book on education called Dumbing Down Our Kids. Those are very culture war sounding titles. Now you've written How the Right Lost Its Mind. Do you still believe in those cultural critiques from your past books?
Well, I'd have to break it down, and you know, they're probably less culture war than the titles might suggest. For example, A Nation of Moochers was written during the height of the corporate welfare, corporate crony years of following the financial crisis, and talked about that as well. But I think part of it is this the shock of what we're experiencing now among conservatives that I would put in my category. Was that we had assumed a reservoir of goodwill and progress that I think we dramatically overestimated. Now, you can think that was incredibly naive, but to realize that we had not come as far as we had. Now, in A Nation of Victims, it talks about the sort of universality that everyone, it does not focus on minority groups. It focuses on all of the people that have decided that if I'm a victim, then I somehow have moral authority, that I'm not responsible for my behavior, whether it's psychological, et cetera. But I do think it's taken an ugly turn. And I think I would just suggest this for social justice activists, because I do think there's a fundamental decency in this country that people want this to be a just society. People want it to be a fair society. People do not want to see racism, and they do not want to see discrimination. But it does matter how it is framed. And if social justice warriors appear to be bullies, if they are demonizing people who disagree with them, if they are demanding conformity, if they are silencing dissent, all of that is going to generate a backlash. And I do think that in order to understand what's happening now, how much of much of Trump conservatism is reactionary to all of that. And somehow we need to get past that that cycle. And by the way, there's a reason why Donald Trump loves going back to issues like the NFL players kneeling. He wants to basically divide this country into people who love America, support the military, support law enforcement, versus people who want to tear it down. So, you know, his agenda, it is very much at the heart of Trumpism to demonize anything associated with social justice. My advice would be, don't make it easy for him.
Charlie Sykes, author of How the Right Lost Its Mind, thank you very much. Michael D'Antonio, executive editor of The Harris Poll, thank you for your collaboration. It's been great during this whole series.
Sure has.
And we will wrap it up in a minute with one final point of view, which we might call a modest proposal for resolving the culture wars between white and people of color, working class America, from Tamara Drought from Demos. Stay with us.